From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a deeper dive into stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today, On Deadline is looking at the relationship between Israel and the United States, which some believe is fraying under the weight of opposition at home over the death of civilians. As Israel continues its effort to destroy Hamas in Gaza, criticism has started to grow from the United States about the death of women and children and other non-military personnel. And that has resulted in a pause in munitions shipments from Israel's staunchest ally, the United States. Israel has been at war with Hamas since last October, and while the country is working to eradicate the terrorist organization, some have questioned its scorched earth strategy that seems to spare no one. Among those who have criticized Israel for being too aggressive in its ground attack in Gaza include top Democrat senators Bernie Sanders and Chuck Schumer, and now the Biden administration. On Sunday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken offered his strongest public criticism of Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza, saying that its tactics have resulted in a, quote, horrible loss of life of innocent civilians. On the other hand, Blinken also said Israel's failure to neutralize Hamas could create an even bigger problem down the road. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded to criticism last month, saying that his nation would make its own decisions about how to conduct the war. But now those decisions could put a fracture in the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Last week, President Joe Biden drew a red line for the first time. He said he wouldn't support an invasion of Rafah. That's the last city Israel says Hamas has a strong footing in. It's a place where more than 1 million Palestinians have been taking refuge for the last few months. Biden is so against the move on Rafah that he decided to pause those munition shipments we mentioned earlier because of it. That's according to Axios. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons, Biden said last week during a sit-down with CNN. Margaret Brennan, a CBS foreign affairs correspondent and moderator of Face the Nation, joined Odyssey to share more on what could happen with our relationship with Israel when this is all said and done.
This seems like a situation where politically the president's kind of caught in between. If you warn Israel about Rafah and you're going to hold back some weapons, you're angering one segment. If you don't help out people in Gaza, you anger another segment.
Right. And unfortunately, we live in this era of everything is binary and everything is hyper politicized and partisan. This is not the first time that a U.S. president has tried to influence Israel's policy by withholding U.S. taxpayer funded and U.S. produced weapons. You know, this happened under President Reagan when there was a objection to how Israel was carrying out an invasion and an assault inside of Lebanon. It has happened in presidency since that time as well. But with Joe Biden right now, we know that this imminent assault is something that his team is trying to influence. It is not an arms embargo. It is not a halt on weapons. In fact, the United States is still surging them to Israel. It was a very specific 3,500 number shipment of dumb bombs, so-called dumb bombs, to Israel that was held, and they are considering whether to withhold other arms shipments. But this has just become absolutely a political firestorm in Washington. I'm going to have Republican Tom Cotton of Arkansas with us, a staunch hawk who is saying this is completely wrong and the president should be impeached. And I will have Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland, who has argued that the president hasn't done enough to try to uphold U.S. and humanitarian law with Israel in terms of making sure it is held to the same standard every other country is held to.
So far, Netanyahu says, I guess, that the operation has been limited in scope as opposed to an invasion. If they continue to do those strategic targeting, will they still get pushback?
Well, President Biden gestured to that idea that he is currently just dancing around the red line in terms of the current assault on Rafah, which is airstrikes in densely populated areas, which involves Israel recently seizing the Palestinian side of that gate to Egypt, the Rafah gate, which has blocked aid and blocked blocked medicines from going in, according to some of the doctors we've talked to. So that encirclement is happening, but the full-on assault that the United States fears hasn't yet been launched. And that is the condition by which President Biden said in that CNN interview, if that full-on assault happens, that's when he would consider withholding further military aid. So he is trying to shape the way that this conflict is carried out. He's not saying don't go into southern Gaza. It's the manner in which you do. do it. That's the nuance here. But I don't know that the communication around that nuance has been very clearly articulated, because certainly in the political sphere, people like one of my guests, Tom Cotton, are arguing that it's binary, that it's go into Rafah or not, finish Hamas or not. Joe Biden's argument publicly has been it's how you do it. And we'll talk to Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland, about that as well.
In response to Biden's decision to pause arms shipments, Israel had harsh words. Netanyahu said last week that Israel would be prepared to stand alone in its war efforts if the U.S. stopped supporting it. To share more on how Israel responded to Biden's threat, Chuck Freilich, a former deputy national security advisor to several Israeli governments, joined Odyssey.
Well, first of all, the president only spoke about that one shipment, and even that one is still under review. A final decision hasn't been made. I very, very much regret the president's decision. I think it's a mistake. Israel faces major challenges, not just in Gaza, but from Hezbollah in Lebanon, from Iran. And I think if things do escalate, the president will rescind the limitations very quickly. I think he set a number of parameters for the war from the very beginning in October. His response from Israel's perspective, I think, could not have been better. Remarkable diplomatic, military, and strategic support, which lasted until very recently, and many days, in many ways today as well. But for a variety of reasons, domestic political reasons, the upcoming elections, international pressure, regional Arab pressure, and I think his own sense of morality led the president in recent weeks and even a couple of months to put growing pressure on Mr. Netanyahu not to go into Rafah. And I don't think the president has a problem with the limited operation currently underway. That's probably a good thing. But he's very concerned that it will expand and that Mr. Netanyahu will continue to rebuff his requests. And he's trying to send a strong signal that he won't accept that.
Israel's national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, tweeted something that was pretty provocative. It was basically Biden hearts with a little heart emoji, Hamas. I'm wondering about the wisdom of saying something to that level. Clearly, there are policy disagreements between the Biden administration and the Netanyahu government about how the war in Gaza has been conducted. And yet the flow of weapons since October 7th, and I mean, look, for it, not always since the beginning of the creation of Israel, but certainly over the last 30 to 40 years, I mean, has been unimpeded and unrivaled in any other relationship across the world between countries. And so to tweet something because he's holding up, and as you point out at the beginning of the interview, not canceling anything yet, no indications that there's going to be bigger curtailments of munitions. It was a very specific hold on a very specific shipment. That Ben-Gvir tweets something like, Biden loves Hamas. Is that a wise strategy? Is that the way to go about repairing relations?
Is that a wise strategy? You're a very polite gentleman. I think my my deepest characterization of Mr. Ben-Gvir is not something that could be broadcast on a public radio station. So, no, it is clearly not a wise thing to do. Mr. Ben-Gvir is a buffoon. The fact that he is in the government of Israel is an absolute disgrace. But the prime minister is beholden to him and a couple of other ultra-extremists in the cabinet because he loses his coalition otherwise. For what it's worth, I would mention that there are some political figures in Washington to whom I would not attribute a far greater wisdom than to Mr. Ben-Gvir, but that's of very little comfort either for Israel or for the United States. So I wouldn't waste words on the man. He is simply a disgrace.
Did not disappoint with a very strong opinion on that. I mean, to that end, while there is publicly, you have the public comments by Mr. Biden, surely you are aware, members of the Israeli government are aware of how big the divide is in this country, which remains solidly pro-Israel, by the way. I mean, in every measure of polling and surveying, the country, even with some consternation about the level of civilian casualties in the Gaza operation, remains overwhelmingly pro-Israel. Does that give you some sense that behind the scenes there are cooler heads that are talking, negotiating, whether it's further arms shipments, whether it's the scope of the Rafah offensive, if and when it fully happens, that, I don't know, that maybe we shouldn't pay quite as much attention to the very heated public rhetoric, or should we not have that kind of confidence that things are going on behind the scenes that are a little bit more calmer, rational?
No, I think behind the scenes, there probably are some calmer and rational things. I think you're correctly putting things in perspective. Yes, the United States remains overwhelmingly supportive of Israel. And I think Mr. Biden is the most pro-Israel president in American history, defines himself as a Zionist. And again, I said it before, I think his overall response towards Israel since the war broke out has been nothing short of remarkable. At the same time, I am very concerned about what's happening because we've never seen anything like this before in the history of the bilateral relationship, because I think Israel has probably lost or is very close to losing an entire generation of young Americans, and it will take a very long time for that to change. And these are people who today mostly are in college or the early years out of college, but they in not very long will be in positions of influence and will take their college experience with them. I'm very concerned. And on the left side of the Democratic Party, positions that just a few years ago were rather extreme are today becoming more mainstream, such as the idea of conditioning military support to Israel on changes in its policies. And one can legitimately disagree with various Israeli policies and think that Israel is wrong in a whole variety of areas, but to ignore the fact that Israel faces threats from Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas, all three of whom call for its extermination, I think is also not the wisest approach.
So, while the U.S. and others seem to be asking Israel to calm down its offensive against Hamas, many are left wondering what the solution is. Hamas is a threat. There's no doubt about that. But are there tactics other than bombings that could eliminate it? CBS military analyst Colonel Jeff McCausland had some thoughts on this while talking with Odyssey in New Orleans.
So let's pivot to Rafah. That has been a target. Allegedly, there are four coordinated battalions of the Hamas military that are located in Rafah. They have been bunkered down there for weeks, if not months now. And the goal of the IDF is to cut the head of the snake off and, you know, take down the military infrastructure of Rafah, I mean, of the Hamas in Rafah. Hamas has decided to go move into, I guess, you know, first it was more urban warfare. It's probably more like jungle warfare at this point in time. You tell me. But it's probably the most difficult type of warfare that exists, right?
I would say unquestionably, because we're talking urban warfare, which is always very difficult. We're talking urban warfare in an unbelievably dense population. I mean, at the onset of the hostilities, about 2.2 million people in the Gaza Strip, rich large. Now in the city of Rafah, prior to the onset of hostilities, had a population of about 300,000. Now has a population of 1.3 million people. How did those 1.3 million people get there? Well, they got there because they actually lived, you know, further north in the Gaza Strip at some point in time. And as the Israelis advanced from north to south, they were urging people by leaflets and radio broadcasts and the like to flee the area and flee south, which they did. So they went to Rafah because that's where they were told they would be safe. And now they're in Rafah, and obviously they're not safe any longer. On top of that, of course, don't forget that Hamas has constructed a tunnel system under the Gaza Strip, which some people have said is in excess of the London Underground. And as a consequence, then you're fighting not only urban warfare, you're fighting subterranean warfare, which some people say is like fighting underwater. And furthermore, that means for a military guy like me, that a lot of the capabilities that we have, the Israelis have, tanks or personnel carriers and that kind of stuff, the effect of those things is somewhat minimized by the nature of that terrain, urban and subterranean. And that's really the problem we've got in terms of dealing with Rafah and the concern the Biden administration has publicly, frankly, and privately expressed. That's pretty clear. The worry that if, in fact, a concerted assault was made into Rafah, like the Israelis have done so far in Gaza City, as well as Khan Yunus and other places, you conduct the attack like you've done in past, then we're going to see that these number of civilian casualties skyrocket. And right now we stand at about 34,000 Palestinians being killed and about 78,000 injured, most of which are civilians.
So what's the alternative?
Well, it ain't any. First of all, everybody keeps looking for the silver bullet, you know, the real elegant. And I'm just saying there ain't no silver bullet out there. People I've talked with who are involved in such operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, would suggest, I think, first of all, that the surgical effort where you try to stand back, because you really, in many ways, what's the hurry? And conduct a surgical series of strikes, which take out particularly the leadership of Hamas and whatever effort then to divide the population from Hamas. And I think there's good reason to believe that, in many ways, the Palestinian people as a whole aren't as supportive of Hamas as many might think. They've been subjected to Hamas really full control since the last election, which was something like 17 years ago. And then second of all, to try to create the conditions whereby you can take them out over time, okay? So that, I think, would be the alternative. Now, the problem with that is it'll take more time. Frankly, it might put your troops in greater harm's way and you might suffer more casualties. But the end result is if I go the other way and I say, well, I'm just going to blow in there and blow this thing away. Okay, you can do that. You have the capability. Even without U.S. support, I would say the Israelis have that capability. But what has happened so far, I think, strategically is I haven't heard anything from the Israeli government in what I've been reading that can answer the question of, and then what? Okay, great. So you go in there and you take Rafah and you kill another 10,000 to 15,000 people. Great. And then what? What do you do then? Okay? Because our rule of thumb in Iraq and Afghanistan was somewhere between 5 to 20 soldiers per 1,000 to control a population. So if you're going to have to control this, you're going to have to occupy this area in the aftermath. Well, we're talking, I don't know, 20 to 50,000 Israeli soldiers in perpetuity. We're going to be nothing but sitting on this 9 by 25 mile square just to keep it like it is. Not make it any better, not make it any worse, just keep things under control. You're basically buying into sort of Northern Ireland and a consequent low to mid-level insurgency, which will continue indefinitely on into the future. And then furthermore, you still got to resolve the other problems you got, which is Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which has got about 60,000 soldiers and about 100,000 rockets. The Syrians, the West Bank, where you have a lot of unrest, which gets exacerbated as this war continues in the Gaza Strip. And the Houthis down in Yemen, who are now saying they're going to expand their level of attacks on commercial shipping. All those things likely, I would argue, to accelerate if, in fact, you do that concerted major assault on Rafah. And then last but not least, the other problem you got is hostages. There's still 100 people who are unaccounted for as hostages. And the concern in Israel for what do we do that might allow us to get to a ceasefire, which might affect the return of at least some of them.
The death toll in Gaza is mounting. The U.S. is hesitant to support efforts that could put more civilians at risk, and Israel is saying it would stand alone if need be. So, right now, it isn't very clear how this is all going to shake out. Will the war end with a fractured relationship between the U.S. and Israel? Is a ceasefire that effectively shuts down Hamas possible? Well, let's turn to two more experts for some insight. Mara Rudman, who held senior Middle East diplomatic roles in the Obama and Clinton administrations, and is now a professor at the University of Virginia, said a pause in arms shipments shouldn't be read as a major break in the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Instead, she said it should maximize efforts to reach a ceasefire that brings out hostages, brings in humanitarian relief, and starts to build a pathway to greater sanity all around. Gerald Feierstein, a veteran U.S. diplomat who's now a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, added to Gulf News that a lot of it just depends on how things play out in Rafah and whether it gets worse. This show is produced by Joe Heady, Christy Strouser, and by me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.